Good evening. Good evening, James McCanny, January 8th, 2009, going directly into my show. And this week, I decided to do something a little bit different, change of pace, which is always good, and talk a little bit about natural resources. And this is a topic, of course, we all are familiar with these issues, the limited amount of resources on Earth. But as most of you know, I spend a good deal of time in third world countries. And it's interesting to see how the rest of the planet lives within their means, many times finding their food sources and shelter sources within miles of their house, and usually from modest natural means. So in a day when we are outstripping our worldwide natural resources, it's wonderful to have big palatial houses and estates and lawns, but the world is not going to be able to do this very much longer. Not everybody in China is going to have a wood house. So I just want to talk a little bit about natural resources and how this relates to lifestyles, and also how this relates to science issues. For example, back in the old days, as you know, I talk about this all the time, the natural disasters that sent the world back pretty much to the cave ages, these things can happen at any time. Hopefully they're not going to happen in the near future. We have a major volcano at this point in Yellowstone, which is not in imminent danger of erupting, but these swarms of earthquakes are a little unsettling. What's more unsettling is that the geologists related to that park are taking a wait-and-see attitude. So I'll talk a little bit more about that. I spent quite a bit of the show last week talking about the Yellowstone volcano. And by the way, so I don't want to spend that much time on this show talking about the volcano in Yellowstone, but I do want to note that after that show last week, it seemed like every major news media on the planet jumped on that topic. And I called a couple of places just to let you know that many times I'm on as a regular, and it turns out that, let's put it this way, there seems to be a new and upcoming list of imposters that they seem to want to post, people with no background, no degrees. We call them information pirates. That's what we call them in the business, people who listen to other people's shows, then pretend like they are the coming up with this material. And I'm sure most of you know who I'm talking about. But ask yourself this, when you see people like this emerging and having week-long radio shows, etc., look for their means of support. And that's always interesting. People with no visible means of support that seem to be touting everybody else's information and then putting a very bizarre twist on it. Let's just put it this way. And then you see them, ask yourself, what is their visible means of support? And you see that they don't have any. Then you've got to start to wonder, how are these people with no degrees, no background, have all of a sudden have a radio show or being placed on radio shows? And isn't that interesting, with a very different twist, many times not talking about the real issues, of course, but it's just one of those things that's happening today. And I also keep mentioning this on just about every show that I do, that you are going to be confronted with immense amounts of disinformation coming at you from every direction, including the 2012 issue. I've told you before, that is just a ruse. It's just another date that somebody has picked out of the sky, and it's coming at you in all directions. There's no Mayan calendar prediction. There is no magical alignment of the galaxy. or anything like that that's going to cause any special activity on December 21st of 2012, but yet you see this everywhere. In fact, I might mention that nobody in standard science is talking about it. And what's very interesting, too, is the naysayers, the white hats, as we call them, the debunkers, those people that don't want anybody talking anything but standard science, they're not saying anything about the 2012 issue. You know why? Because actually they're all in the same camp. They're all paid from the same trough, let's put it that way. And so it's very interesting to see who they criticize and who they don't criticize. And in the case of 2012, in fact, some of our textbook repeater astronomer critics that filter around on the internet don't say anything about the 2012 thing, and you would think they would be all over that as bad science, but, of course, as I said, they're being funded from the same team, the same disinformation team, so they don't want to badmouth their own counterparts, so to speak. But at any rate, back to the main science topic, which I mentioned was natural resources. First, let me weave in a couple other topics here that were in the news this past week. Obama, our future president, almost here in a couple days, has stated that he would like to see the military and NASA join forces so that we could get to the moon sooner. In other words, speed up the moon program and therefore beat the Chinese, because the Chinese are a real threat. I've talked about this, many years ago. I said the Chinese are the biggest threat to the United States space program, and actually, in more ways than one, I don't particularly see it as a threat. Actually, I think the U.S. just dropped the ball. It's pretty clear that it's highly questionable, let's put it that way. It's highly questionable if they even went to the moon in the first place. But Mr. Obama doesn't understand the fundamental issues, the fundamental problems with the space program as we have it today. The fundamental problem with the space program is that there is something called the Van Allen belts and space radiation. And the U.S. space program, whether you're talking about the military or NASA, has not learned how to deal with this. They have a major program underway called Living with a Star. Isn't that a cute little name? But what it really means is, how do we go into space and live with all of the radiation hazards that are out there? Which, of course, brings up the question, if there was no such problem in 1969, and all these guys from NASA and the Apollo mission were flying back and forth to the moon, and they all lived to ripe old ages and never had a problem, then what's the problem now? And, of course, there are literally thousands upon thousands of scientists working on the Living with a Star program. You can look that up under NASA. But as I said, what it really means is, how the heck do we go into outer space and live with radiation? And so that is a bigger problem than just combining the military and NASA, because it is a real issue. And of course, there are ways to solve any problem, but I would bet that the Chinese are going to be more innovative in that respect. The other thing is that we have a space program that has always been built on the model that aerospace corporations have to make a lot of money, number one. That takes away from the bottom line of actually getting people into space. Number two, we have always had a space program based on building everything on Earth and taking it into space, including the food and supplies. In other words, people in outer space are simply totally dependent on Earth-based product development, products being built and shipped up there for their consumption. So they are simply consumers. They are not, they never have learned how to live in outer space. So in that respect, I suspect the Chinese will be far advanced because they are going to live in outer space. I should also mention that it is really, in the overall view of things, it's far more important for us to develop space colonies, free-floating space colonies. It is far, far more difficult to land somebody on another celestial object like the Moon or Mars and then try to deal with all the issues that arise from just being on that other object. The lack of atmosphere, trying to mine, they have all of these ideas. But those are all good, but just the fact that you are then strapped to this other celestial body, plus you have to have all of the fuel, here's where one of the big problems comes in, you have to have fuel to slow yourself down for the landing, and then if you want to get off, you have to have the fuel to get out of the gravitational well of that other celestial object. And so that poses a huge obstacle. And landing on another object, there are no runways, of course, so there's no atmosphere to speak of, and that includes Mars. There's not enough atmosphere, really, for lift, for wings. So in the case of Mars, you're landing almost like on the Moon with pretty much what you would call a crash landing. Mars is going to even be a little bit more difficult to land on because it has just a small atmosphere. But the whole issue of landing on another celestial object and then having to take off and get your people off of it is a complication in itself, which, of course, would be much easier solved if you just concentrated on space colonies. And then once you mastered the idea of space colonies, then attempt to land on another object. But we're going to put all of our time, all of our resources into landing one man on the Moon again, probably a good, 70 to 2020, is when they're planning, 50 years after the first man supposedly landed there. And what is the value of landing one man on the Moon? Pretty much useless. It's bragging rights only, and pretty much useless. And now let's look at the Obama plan for putting the military in conjunction with NASA. In a sense, they've always been somewhat related. NASA has always been a government agency that worked freely with the military. But as I've said before, NASA has always been a smokescreen for the real space program. You can't tell me that there aren't some smart people out there doing some interesting things in space, and all we get is what we see from NASA? Nah, I don't think so. First of all, I would venture to say very clearly the black space program, as we might call it, would certainly have a lot more hardware on Mars. Looking around, especially for ancient artifacts, the kind of things worshipped by the secret societies. They worship that more than oil, more than gold, more than power on this planet. They worship the antiquities. And so you better believe that their black ops scientists are out there with their all of their equipment, etc., a lot more than those little Mars rovers that we get information from, and looking for the real interesting things on Mars. Remember, I did a talk once about Baal, the character from biblical times, from ancient times, who allegedly was based on Mars at one time, and when the catastrophes hit, when the giant comet came through the solar system that eventually became the planet Venus, Baal bailed from Mars and landed in somewhere in Middle Europe, to what we call Transylvania. And that is a whole group of people that, now, when I gave those shows, I always got a lot of resistance. There was a lot of things that happened to me in the background that you people never see or never hear about. But I knew I was hitting the nail on the head when I talked about that. I also know from people that I know in the business, so to speak, or in the industry, or being around the black ops group, and also the what you might call the secret societies, the ones that run the World Banks and their families, that they have a close relationship, let's put it that way, or they have a very secret set of, let's say, historical perspectives that relate them to outer space in some way during the ancient days when there was outer space activity back way back then before the great catastrophe. So you know that those people are very interested in getting back to Mars to find what is on Mars in terms of antiquities, ancient buildings, ancient structures, etc. But all stemming from the topic of Obama stating that the military and NASA should join forces. So remember, NASA is supposed to be a civilian space agency, but has always been military-oriented. The military, of course, has their own programs. There's a lot going on in the background that you never hear about. And just as an example, a couple of years ago, what year was it? I forget. I think it was about 2005 when the national budget came out. It was very interesting to see that the Navy had $60 billion in procurement for outer space. Now, you got to ask yourself, what is the Navy doing with $60 billion for an annual procurement budget for outer space? And when you see that NASA only has about $17 billion, certainly there is a lot of activity going on in the background which you and I never see, being average citizens. So, at any rate, the combination of the military and NASA comes as no surprise to me. It's just that I think it's just one more smokescreen to make the public think that we are doing something about getting into outer space. And, of course, the rocket technology they're developing is pretty much worthless. It might get a few people or a few pieces of hardware into space and possibly even to the moon. Who knows? But the end result is that a guy like Obama, with very little, if any, knowledge of space, the history of the space program, is certainly ill-equipped to be promoting anything. And there, of course, all the infighting going back and forth between the Obama's team that he has selected to bring NASA into the Obama age. Anyway, back to that's just a side topic, but look for, in that respect, very little progress. I expect that in the background, if the military and NASA ever do get joined in any way, it will simply be infighting over who gets to do what, or whose funding does this, or who gets information from one agency to the other. They're going to become more secretive relative to each other than they are with the public about what they're doing. So at any rate, that's a little bit of an aside there. I want to quick talk about the volcano in Yellowstone. The ancient volcanic eruptions were massive. The most recent one was actually only about 35,000 years ago. And the geologists at Yellowstone seem to have their head in the sand. They seem to be watching the volcano, and they have better tools at this time to watch. They have sensors that have been drilled into the ground. But here is the entire problem, that, once again, the lake, which sits in the caldera, if for some reason it drains into the caverns and the chasms down below the park and gets down to the magma layer, which is about 10 kilometers down, and also where the majority of the earthquakes are active right now. They're typically about 10 kilometers underground. But if for some reason that water could find its way down, and then, of course, it would turn into superheated steam, all of a sudden it's going to start blowing the top, that 10 kilometers of caldera, and about 1,500 square kilometers of surface area. So you have an incredible, absolute incredible amount of land that could be airborne overnight. And so there's the problem, and the responses we've been getting from the geologists in Yellowstone relative to the lake there is they don't see any immediate problem. Well, the lake is not going to be drained in a moment of panic and emergency. It's going to take probably years to drain out that lake. It's a complex lake. It's not a nice big circle. And so it would take many years to actually drain that lake and move it. Now, I developed a plan. I talked about this years ago on many radio shows. Excuse me, dealing with a method to siphon, the old siphon technique where you put a tube down in the lake and move it around, or put it down in the low region of the lake, the same kind of tube that you use for moving oil, and start draining the lake into a region in southern Wyoming. And of course the water is polluted because of the gases, the poisonous gases that have been belching into it from underneath, from the volcanic, gases coming out of the volcanic caldera. So eventually, though, that water, once it got into a different location, would self-purify. It would take quite a bit of time, but it would then form a nice lake somewhere else. But to allow that to sit there is negligent, because someday, if the eruptions ever become large enough, you can't just drain that lake off in an instant. It's a long-term project, something that has to be done, and it has to be done because if that water were turned into steam, this would be a good project for high school students. Take the volume of water in the lake in Yellowstone Park, take that volume of water and convert it into steam, using the heat from the magma, and estimate the amount of energy in terms of nuclear bombs that that would convert into, say like 50 megaton bombs, as they always compare to, that were used in Japan as one of the standard comparative large energy units, and convert the water in the lake in Yellowstone Park to energy based on the conversion to steam, and what you're going to find is that it would take that 1,500 kilometer area, about 10 kilometers deep, and throw that into the atmosphere. It would be a disaster for the entire world. So I'm going to continue working on the project, and here again you've got a guy like Obama becoming president, really green behind the ears. We're facing major issues like this, and he is not in a position to really understand, and I'm sure a president like that would say, well, we have these trained geologists out there in Yellowstone, and they, in fact, are our experts, so I'll take their opinion. And when in reality, it's usually those people, those very people, that could not be entrusted with a big project like this. This has to come from outside, and it will never be done by the geologists who work in the park themselves. And I'm sure they're all well-meaning people. They're well-educated, and they have a lot of training. But the removal of the water from Yellowstone Lake is something that simply has to be done, and it has to be done for future generations. It has to be done now when we have the technology to do this. So, at any rate, just one other note, I have to say this every show now. The advertisements you may have heard just leading right up to my show for black filters, those are not my ads. I don't sell those anymore. I sell the Dalton brand 3-part ceramic water filters, and of course the casing is, the canisters are stainless steel. But the ceramic filter elements themselves are a 3-part filter, And the problem with the black filters, they plugged up in testing that we did, of course, last spring in Iowa. Many of you have already heard me talk about that. But the Dalton three-part ceramic filter is made with an outer casing, highly controlled manufacturing process. It's a true filter. In other words, it has a pore size which is controlled in the manufacturing process. When the material is formed and baked, then the inner ceramic shell keeps the carbon centerpiece from moving down into the water. So there's a three-part system. There's an outer ceramic shell, there's an inner ceramic shell, and between those shells is the black carbon, and it's in the center of those ceramic shells for a very good reason, because all of that the carbon does is take out chemicals. So it's not meant to be a filter element. So the carbon is just an absorber. It absorbs chemicals out of the water. So you first filter it through the first ceramic filter layer, the outer shell. That's a true filter. It's cleanable, meaning you can wipe off just the very outer edge, rub it very lightly, and all of the scum or the silt, whatever, that is trapped in that filter, outer ceramic filter element, goes away, and you can re-clean it hundreds of times. Then the carbon is in the center, and it can do its work on the chemicals to take the chemicals out of the water, and then the inner ceramic shell is a final filter and also keeps the carbon from going into the water that you're drinking. So the three-part Dalton ceramic filter is designed. It's been built this way for over 150 years, and it's built that way for a reason. So for someone to take simply the center part of that, the carbon, and call it a filter is simply incorrect. And so in my effort to bring the best information to you, the public, that's what I'm selling. And so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. You can go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. That's 7 letters, JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com, and get more details on those, on the Dalton three-part ceramic filters. Okay, on to the main science topic. Imagine a society that lived within their means. And now, throughout history, we have legends of these. But imagine a society that took the foresight, that took the initiative to design a society where they lived within their means and spent most of their time, instead of running around working 8-to-5 jobs and many of them doing useless work, driving SUVs back and forth in rush hour traffic and building very nice homes in the suburbs and honoring and obeying money. Imagine a society that is based on getting your food from the local source, relatively local. And of course, there's trade, there's commerce that moves products around. But the main issue is not buying bigger, better digital TVs, not buying bigger and better automobiles, and all of the things that go with modern society. Travel would be much slower, but the idea is that you would enjoy travel. The idea would not be to get on a freeway and go across the country in 3 days in an automobile or a train or in a couple hours in an airplane. And of course, we can have all of the things we have in modern society and still have somewhat of a bucolic or countryside type of lifestyle. I just wanted to read a list of natural resources, and they kind of all have something in common. Bamboo, cedar, rock, buffalo, leather, flint, soft metals like copper, gold, and silver, sod roofs, thatched roofs, twine, rope made from natural materials, spinning threads and weaving materials, natural natural, what you might call, devices like archery and what's known as the atlatl, a spear thrower, filtering water through dirt mounds as a method of getting fresh water, and just also spending time talking. Now, these materials that I listed off have been used, of course, for centuries and, you know, since the dawn of man. Bamboo, of course, is something that mainly was in the East and used for everything, for cooking, for shelter, for furniture, for making everything that you would use in your life just about from bamboo. Cedar, if you're familiar with the Native American Indians, cedar was, they believed, was given to them by the gods, that cedar was such a remarkable material because it was easy to work. They could split it using very rudimentary tools, and it lasted forever. It didn't rot, and it was very strong. It had a tremendous amount of tensile strength. It was flexible. And so it was kind of like bamboo to the Native American Indians, as bamboo would be to the Eastern cultures. Rock, hard, soft, and medium strength rock, of course, was used for building. And there are techniques for building where you don't even use cement. You can build structures, and it's the method of placing the rocks so that they stay together. I talked about buffalo, leather, flint, and this might sound like a strange series of topics for a science show, but the point is, if we go back to the purpose of science, and that is to better the living standards of man, I would hope that would be one of the main considerations for science, then what do we do as a culture, as a civilization, as a species on this planet, when all of the world resources are coming to an end? How can people turn around? The great forests of Russia are being cut down. The South American large trees are being cut down at a record pace. And in a few years, we're going to simply be out of resources. Some people believe we're running out of oil, at least the easy oil, the oil that is easily obtainable, the surface oil. There are, you know, indications that even if there is more oil, we can't keep using it because of the vast amount of pollution it causes. So the issue is, how as a society do scientists take what we've got, or what we've got left, I should say, and turn it into a livable society? Now, take a civilization like the legendary continent of Mu. It's pretty clear that this continent did exist in history, and it appears that it was the remnants of that civilization became the Polynesians. The Atlanteans, of course, had a society that was going on at the same time. And you could probably liken them to the current United States. Very warlike, very aggressive, commercially very aggressive, covering the world with their trade and securing natural resources from the four corners of the globe. That's why so many people think Atlantis was in so many different places, because literally it was. It was a civilization that was moving out around the Earth at that time, and of course the Earth was a very different place in those days, in the pre-catastrophe days. Remember that the continent of Antarctica was a tropical, in a semi-tropical location, about 30 degrees off of where it is now, and that the region that that was one of the main passage routes, and the where we now have the North Pole, the North Polar Cap, remember, is just floating. There's no continent underneath it. That was a major trade route. And so the Earth was situated quite differently. The entire ocean of the world was called the Atlantic Ocean, or the Ocean of the Atlanteans. And so they were worldwide, but they were very aggressive, very warlike, and very technologically advanced, whereas the continent of Mu, which apparently extended from about the mid-Pacific west to Japan, this was a region that was populated by a group of people, and supposedly these cultures lived, although they had catastrophes mixed in, major catastrophes, possibly where large celestial objects came through the solar system. But the legend states that these civilizations existed for about 10,000 years, somewhat interrupted, but not completely, and they developed a culture where they were self-sufficient for this long period of time. The reason I'm bringing this up is because imagine a world that we live in today where we're running out of resources, wood, timber, other resources, energy resources, and imagine that all of a sudden one society looks at the future and says, okay, we cannot continue living like this. How are we going to structure a society in which we can live within our means and for a very long period of time, so in 3 or in 5 or in 10 generations the people can live exactly like we are? And of course we're not living today in a society or in a culture that we can say that. We cannot say, given the way we are living today in the United States or Europe or any of the developed, what we call the first world countries, we cannot say, in fact, you would be a fool to say, that people in the next generation or the next generation after that or the third or the fifth or the tenth generation will be able to live like we do. In fact, there's a little drawing I had some people draw up, and it was of some children dressed in rags and sitting outside a smoldering city. And the caption was, "I wish our parents wouldn't have used up all of the energy." And that's the image that I get of someday what we're going to leave future generations. And it's a pretty bleak picture. It somewhat says it all. These young kids sitting there around maybe a little teeny fire, broken chairs that they're burning up just to stay warm, with this smoldering city in the background, saying, "I wish our parents wouldn't have used up all the energy." And that's really what's happening. We are using energy uselessly on a daily basis, phenomenal amounts of energy for people to drive back and forth to work. Where can we change? Now, the current president, Obama, is trying to maintain a culture which cannot succeed. We can't continue to use resources. The economic model, so to speak, of capitalism only works if you have unlimited resources. Capitalism is a system where if you have enough resources, you can get the people to go out and garnish those resources, turn them into homes and roads, cars, automobiles, and every other product under the sun. And then the money would come in from the sources of money, whatever that might be, and people would progress and have this amazing lifestyle. But it's breaking down for many reasons. One of them, of course, is interest on money. But this is not a show about banking. It is a show about resources. Whether you agree with the monetary system or the banking system we have today, whether you agree with it or not, the simple fact is that capitalism is a system that depends on unlimited resources, and we are no longer in that position. Very simple. And now one might think, well, gee, are you preaching communism? No, because communism does exactly the same thing. They simply fool their people into working for nothing, all for the common good of the country, of Mother Russia or whatever country they're talking about. So communism is not a solution because literally they do the same thing. They base their economy, if you want to call it that, on natural resources. And when those natural resources run out, then the economy runs out of steam and people are forced back to an agrarian lifestyle, something that we would have had somewhere in the middle of the 1800s or previously, where transportation is no longer there, where all of the communications is no longer there, and people simply live within their means and probably get most of their food and building material from within a few miles of where they live. So some people, if they live in a natural resource rich area, do a bit better. Or if people were living down in the southwest United States, things were pretty lean for the natural occurring the native population there. But of course they lived within their means, and of course it took a much larger land area to support a single person than it would, say, in a state like Wisconsin or Iowa or Indiana when the white man first came. A 10-acre plot was enough to live off of. You had enough firewood, you had enough trees to build a house, you had enough room for a huge garden, there were deer in the woods to shoot. Out on the plains, the Indians had the buffaloes, the buffalo. And I always like to mention this one little fact, that if the buffalo herds that were originally on the Great Plains, if those were still here today, it would be enough to feed on an ongoing basis the entire population of the United States, meat supply. Isn't that interesting? But there again, it is all gone. All of those resources are gone. The vast amount of trees that were on this continent, we now look at Indiana and Ohio mainly as farming states with most of the trees cut down. And if you looked at the percentage of wooded land in Ohio or Virginia, has a little bit more, but Indiana, we just consider it almost wall-to-wall farming. You find little tree patches here and there, but remember that that was solid forest, huge trees, when the white man first came. So could we ever get it back to that state? And the question is, how do we convert a mentality? Remember my corn project from last spring, or last summer, I guess it was later in the summer, when I sold the non-GMO corn seeds that I had found, and found that that was the last supply of true, the original corn stock that you would have found on the family farm back in the 1930s or going back to the Civil War. And that those people who recognized what I was doing purchased that and now have that, and then pretty soon, in a couple months, many of them will start to grow that. And I know some people had already started that lived in some of the southern states or some other regions where it was a warmer climate. They've already begun growing that. So that is, imagine, and in doing that project, what I learned is how difficult it would be to get back to a completely organic, non-GMO, non-genetically modified plant supply and food supply in this country. I know there are a lot of people selling organic food with the organic label, but most of it is not. Most of it is hybrid seeds. They're growing it organically, so you have to watch out for that organic label. But to get back to where we were farming and agricultural-wise in the 1930s would be literally almost impossible. It would take a vast, concerted national effort, and that is being opposed violently by the mega agricultural corporations. And, of course, they have laws that prevent that type of thing. I should mention now, I don't know if I ever mentioned this on the show regarding the corn seed project, but the certain countries actually blocked the passage of those seeds into the country, including Australia. Australia, many people from Australia ordered the corn seeds, and of course they wanted to. Australians are very ecological minded. They're a group of people who live very close to the earth and the planet. They've always been very self-sufficient, and so many people in Australia ordered the seeds, and they were blocked from going into that country because the big seed manufacturing corporations have passed laws preventing non-GMO seeds from going into Australia. I don't know if I've ever mentioned that on this show, but that was one of the results. But they did get into many, many other countries. But you can see that there's a lot of control of this type of activity and a huge effort to prevent the earth from going back to where we would have been in the 1930s with true organic farming, non-genetically modified seed stock, etc., etc. So seeing that it's almost impossible to move the world back to that state, then also seeing that it appears that man-made disasters could be used to beef up the case that only genetically modified food can be used to feed the masses of the world. And that's an argument that I've seen more and more, both in private communications and very subtly in the news, that only genetically modified food will be able to feed the world population, and that is what has to come along, that's what has to happen in the future. So you're going to find that becoming a self-sufficient population is going to be harder and harder to do. The other thing I learned during the Corn Seed Project is that if we have real natural disasters, there will be a population, or there will be a big disaster in agriculture, because the GMO, the genetically modified seeds, will go away after the first year. The GMO farming methods depend strictly on the ability for the seed companies to raise their seeds and get it to market, get it into the hands of the farmers, and then it also depends on the fact that they have depleted the natural resources in the soil so that the soil will only support GMO-type seeds. In other words, you can look on a map, and in fact I talked about this back in those days, that if you look on a map, you can Google searches, etc., and look for the most depleted farming land in the world. And what you'll find is that the central United States, what we consider our breadbasket or our high growth states, is some of the most depleted land in the world. And that's due to overfarming. That's due to using GMO agricultural techniques where you simply put fertilizer in a growth medium, which is now sand in many of these places, where there were feet and feet of topsoil, like in Indiana and Ohio. There is only a thin layer, if any, left, and the crops are raised because you're adding artificial fertilizers, ammonia-based fertilizers. And so this is how corn and soybeans, these huge crops that are being grown today, that's how they're grown in this vast central region of the United States. But if there was a disaster, let's say that Yellowstone had a mini volcano and sprinkled these regions with ash and sulfur, and for in a single year that big GMO industry failed, then the worldwide population would suffer because the genetic stock that they were using to develop the GMO seeds would be gone, and we would literally have no seed base to continue, even if we wanted to continue organically, because all of the effort of the seed companies is being put into genetically modified seed and the agricultural system we have today. So at that point, you might call it a thinning of the herd. You might call it a natural disaster, but starvation would follow. And there have been times when this has happened, for example, in the Middle Ages, due to volcanic eruptions, the exact same thing. When Krakatoa had an explosion, and then there was another one was at Tambora, was an explosion that also sent the world into a mini cooling period with dust in the atmosphere. And so there were two times when there was somewhat mass starvation around the planet simply because of the a volcano going off and causing global cooling. And then but the difference was that the seed stock in those days was a natural seed stock and the world could recover. Imagine a volcanic eruption, whether it be Yellowstone, whether it be somewhere in the South Pacific, in Asia, in, say, one of the volcanoes up in the Kamchatka region of Russia. Imagine one of these going off on a large scale on an ongoing basis for maybe 6 months and putting a good deal of ash in the atmosphere, cooling the planet. And this would then destroy the seed stock of the GMO companies, and the Earth would simply not be able to recover because we don't have the seed base to bring agricultural back after the disaster ended, as they were able to recover back in the Middle Ages after Krakatoa and Tambora and those other volcanoes went off. The Earth was able to recover fairly quickly agriculturally because they had a seed base, and of course seeds within a couple seasons generate, that's something I didn't talk a lot about during the seed corn, the corn seed project, but there was some information we got that if you took, I believe it was 1 cubic inch of wheat seeds and raised them the first year and you took all of the seed stock that was generated from that 1 cubic inch of seed, and you did that for 7 years in a row, you would have more wheat than you could plant in the entire United States, wall to wall, north to south, east to west. There would not be enough land to plant all of the wheat that resulted in 7 short years. So you can see that the generation, the multiplication of loaves and fishes, so to speak, but in the case of grains, would be very rapid. But the problem is now with GMO, genetically modified seed base, the nations will not be able to recover that quickly. Because if you look at the seed I was selling was corn, how about other varieties, all the other varieties of food that we eat? Going back to the original topic, the natural resources of the world are dwindling at this point, and I know there are many people out there that want to find a way to reduce their own what we call footprint, and this is going to have to be done on an individual basis. And these are the people, if we do have a natural disaster due to volcanic eruption, an object coming through the solar system, or any of the other natural disasters that can occur due to, a plethora of sources, then the individuals who have set up their lifestyle to be simple and to be self-supportive, those are the people who are going to fare quite well. And also, what's very interesting, they will probably be the happiest in the meantime, not running up and down the road every day trying to fight rush hour traffic. The people who just get away and say, okay, I've had enough. I'm leaving this society to go live in a calmer place. And you can still be part of society. You can still, have your children mixing with society as much as possible, as much as you would like. But the point is that when it comes to the essentials, your food, your water, your source of housing material, etc. If it's right there, then you are someone who is living within your means and are able to take care of yourself. And I think that's the main point here. But it's unfortunate, as a society, there are so many roadblocks in place to prevent society as a whole from doing this. That's why I chose this show to go a little bit off from the topic of science and comets and planets and outer space and electric fields and all the other things I talk about, And just talk about something that's a little closer to home, and imagine that the one other point I wanted to make is straight about comets. You remember that the work I've done on comets clearly shows how these big comets, not the little ones, not the Halley's comets, not the comet Hyakutake or any of the other small comets, but the big ones that can come through the solar system, these are natural events. Just like a forest fire, just like a volcano going off, just like a landslide that causes a tidal wave or tsunami, all of these are natural events. And man has been basically set back many times in his existence due to these natural events. And even if we get into outer space, there's no guarantee that outer space colonies will be safe. There's a whole new set of dangers out there. But it's the only place where man will be able to truly survive on the long term, because eventually this planet will probably be probably succumb to one of the major disasters. And man has survived the last few of these. But there's no guarantee that he will survive as a species through future ones. If you look at Mars, which completely lost its atmosphere back during the last major catastrophe when a comet came through the solar system, nothing survived on the planet Mars. Not a single living thing, tree or shrub or plant. There might be a little bit of bacteria left there, but when it took the atmosphere and the oceans and the water off of Mars, that was pretty much it for that planet. It is going to recover someday, but in millions and millions of years. It'll regain its atmosphere, it'll regain the water, and become a viable planet again, but certainly not in any time frame that we would want to anticipate going back there. So, but as far as people basically planning the future, if we're going to plan a future on this planet, then it should be in terms of existing within our means, using local materials for building out of stone instead of trees and timber, letting the trees grow so that we can have a viable functional planet in terms of plant life, and trying to get back to normal. But as I said, it's unfortunate there are so many laws and regulations in place. Just imagine that a simple house like that would probably be illegal in most cities, in most zoning districts that you would find. There again, people, there are enough places for the few people that do want to get away and have their own private lifestyle. There are enough places where you can still go and live peacefully. And also you find that the natives who live in these regions are very happy people. They always have a smile on their face. They seem to be, they're not aware of all of the craziness going on in the rest of the world, although it does affect them also. But anyway, I just wanted to divert my main science topics this week to talk a little bit about living for the long term. And also just being your own source of food, fresh water, all of those things you need on a daily basis to survive. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.